This is Charles Amerikanian. In the studio with me is composer Philip Glass, who will be appearing at Davies Symphony Hall on Sunday, the 21st of April, at 8 p.m. with his ensemble. And Philip, why don't we begin by discussing the music you're going to be performing at this event?
Well, I'll be bringing some pieces that'll be new to audiences here. They'll be apart from the Cologne Civil Wars, which is a Bob Wilson work that I wrote some. I wrote two parts for the Rome part and the Cologne part, and this will be some of the music from Cologne. And there'll be a part from the opera Akhenaten, which is now included in a dance piece that Jerry Robbins did for the New York City Ballet called Glass Pieces, and we play that as part of that ballet score. There's several other new pieces which we're rehearsing now. I'm just not sure whether they'll be ready by then, but anyway, there'll be those two new pieces. We've just come from a revival of Einstein on the Beach at the Brooklyn Academy of Music in New York, and we're going to probably begin playing some of that music again, which we haven't for some years.
For me, when I think of your music, the stuff that really has knocked me out in performance has been the work with this ensemble. Amplified, tight performances of very difficult scores. I think a lot of the people who think of virtuosity as being represented by the music of Elliot Carter and Pierre Boulez would have difficulty playing your music, and yet these musicians have been doing it for years and doing it brilliantly. Is it a difficulty then when you try to write for a large orchestra or another kind of ensemble?
You bet. You know, one of the things that it's interesting about how the way we play music changes. And in a way, it can't be any other way. If a new musical language requires a new performance technique, if you think about it, that's just the way it has to be. And the difficulty is that you go. I remember this last November, we had a part of the Civil Wars. The Rome section was played by the LA Philharmonic. Neil Stahlberg conducted, and they played it very, very well, very well. But they were furious.
The musicians were.
Because the music was so hard. Now, it was so hard to play. By that, it was hard in a way they weren't used to. They had to play very similar kinds of music over long periods of time, and they had to play it very accurately. It's almost like one of the things that I used to joke with the musicians is that I found a new way of making music hard to play again. And it's a kind of funny thing. Well, it's very easy to do. All you have to have is a very fine sense of intonation and a very sharp sense of rhythm, which is what, in a way, you always need in music. But one of the difficulties with this music is that the music invites you to hear it in a very precise way. One of the things about recording this music, which has become the most demanding, is precisely that, the intonation and the rhythm.
What about the editing?
Oh, it's just almost none.
So the idea that performing your music doesn't require memory and listening to it doesn't require memory is a bit false, then. In other words, many critics have said, well, you have to give up your long and hard-gained function of thinking of one part of the music as relating to another. In other words,
I don't know if that's true. That's never even occurred to me. That, in fact, with Einstein on the Beach, which is done in performance, which you saw in
yes,
New York,
yes, you, fabulous.
There, you're looking at a chorus which is memorized about the whole evening is about 4.5 hours. There's about 2 hours and 20 minutes of music that chorus is memorized, and I don't know how they did it, but
no,
they did
it's
it.
Amazing.
You learn to do it. And I was talking to them, and they said, well, in fact, they learned that music. Some of them learned it in less than a month. And their ways of memorizing, you just find people who are used to memorizing find tricks of doing it. The early pieces I used to memorize, I used to play all the pieces from memory. And when I started the ensemble in '68, I had the idea that I would get the ensemble to play from memory. And I explained to them how to do it, how to think of the pieces in terms of a structure. And if they could think of the structure, they could always remember where they were. And as long as they knew where they were, then they could just proceeding if they knew what the process of the music was. And they looked at me like I was nuts. And they just absolutely, I was the only one. So finally, they all play from printed music now. And I think one of the important things, by the way, as long as we're talking about it, is it's one of the important things to remember about this music is that it's in the tradition of notated music. This is not improvised music. One of the interesting things for people who see for the first time, who may know the music from records, and they are sometimes surprised, is that it's all done live. That there are, we don't use any, there are no tape loops or sequencers or anything like that. In fact, we found that it couldn't really be done that way. The music, it changes too much.
There are too many irregularities.
It's, yeah, what the art of it is, the irregularity. The impression of continuity is done through a lot of very minute changes that are happening all the time.
What about this issue that critics have leveled, though, that this kind of music, repetitive music, doesn't require the function of memory to appreciate? You can just bathe in it, and you don't have to listen to the relationship of the first part to the second to the third part.
People have always said, you know, Charles, I think, you know, I'm sure that you're just trying to get me to lash out at these people, aren't you? The fools, the knaves.
I'm curious to know if what they say is true, actually.
It isn't true for me. And I know that...
You're thinking in terms of building blocks and relationships.
It's not true for me. I think, especially in the theater pieces, pieces like Satya Graha or Ignaton, which have now come quite a ways from... I mean, we're looking now, in terms of my personal body of work, we're looking at 20 years of work now. Obviously, there are big differences from the music from 65 to 74 was very reductive and was what people used to call minimal. I think there are even people who still call that. But the music since 76 has been really theater music. A lot of it has been. And there you're talking about the structure of time in theater pieces is quite different from concert pieces. And I don't see how... What was that about? The function of memory isn't present. I don't even know what it means.
There's more of a challenge, perhaps, if you're trying to find the 12-tone row at the beginning of the piece and follow the variations.
Oh, that's a bunch of baloney. Don't forget about that.
Nobody actually can do that anyway.
Who cares? Who cares? The music isn't about that. I mean, in terms, as professionals, we like to know about things like that, and we analyze each other's music, and it's part of the fun of going to music school when you try to figure out all that stuff. And certainly, in terms of what we hear in music, the music that has strong structural roots in it tends to be the music that is interesting on other levels. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But I doubt whether many people who have listened to the Schoenberg Quartets, I doubt if they understand the structure any more than they understand the structure of Einstein on the Beach. And I don't think it's important. I think that for most listeners, the level of listening, I mean, it changes a lot according to who we are and what we bring to it. And there's no doubt that the more we bring to something, the more we get out of it. But I don't expect an audience who comes to hear Einstein on the Beach, which is a large 4.5-hour work, to be aware of the fact that the music in the knee place develops over a period of 4.5 hours, and each time that music appears, it's different. It's not part of the content of the music that I think we can expect people to hear. On the other hand, I don't doubt that that the structural integrity of the music, I don't doubt that that is conveyed to the audience in terms of the emotional integrity of the piece.
It seems to me that the very scale of Einstein, when I saw it this past December in New York, was so overwhelming and surprising that... That alone carries the thing forward. I thought that over 4.5 hours I was going to get bored at some point, but I had trouble getting out to go to the John and coming back. I didn't want to leave for a minute.
I know, it's curious, isn't
it? It's very, very compelling, and it's hard to describe to people who haven't seen it before.
People ask me, what's a good time? I think we should mention that there aren't any intermissions in this piece. That's what Charles is referring to. And people say, well, what's a good time for me to... And of course, people have to leave at some point. It's a funny thing that Bob and I did. And when we were doing the piece, I mean, we made this thing up in 74 and 75. We were working on it. We decided at that point that we would do a piece that had no intermissions. And that would be a piece, I don't know, today that is, I'm not quite sure why we... At the time, it seemed like a good idea. Let me just say that. That would be a piece that almost no one could hear the whole piece. At one point, you'd have to leave. It's almost like those Japanese gardens that you can't see the whole... it's an idea that's not far from the certain ideas of modern sculpture, where there's certain sculptures that you can't see the whole piece, you know. And it's the intention of the piece that it can't be seen in that way. So it's a curious thing in that way, that we made that decision to do it that way. And then when let me just say also that I've never done a piece like that since then. So there are intermissions in all the other operas. In that piece, we did it that way. Though I've spoken to people who have sat through it, I haven't. I've gone out. Of course, I've seen the piece 45 times. I've played in it 45 times. And people say, well, what is a good time to leave? And I really don't know.
What happens in the pit with the musicians?
Well,
do you have breaks?
In fact, no one actually plays all the way through. If you listen to the music, you'll hear there are places. For example, there's a cappella chorus part. There's one dance, of the two dances, one is for six voices and synthesizer and violin. The other dance is for all the wind players and two synthesizers. No one really has to be in the pit for, I think the longest stretch is maybe an hour and 30 minutes without taking a break, which isn't, it's not that long. I mean, it's something that we all are able to do. The singers have, they never sing for more than, after 30 or 40 minutes, and they may have a break of half an hour.
They're earning their pay at any rate.
It's a hard piece. It's funny, the piece, it's a hard piece to do, and people, the performers, not one performer ever complained about it. Of course, we pay them pretty well. But apart from that, it was interesting hearing how they react to the piece. I was backstage one night with the chorus, and the first hour and a half was over. That would be Act One, and we were about to start Act Two. And we were halfway through Act Two, and one of the singers said to me, "Okay," "okay, here comes the meat." And I never thought about it that way, but she had thought of the piece. To her, the piece from Act Two on, it began to build, and I began to think of it from her point of view. And I thought, well, there was something to that, you know, that in a way, the whole beginning was kind of an introduction of about 2 hours. And then the piece really starts rolling. And it's interesting hearing how people react to it that way, because I had never spoken to them that way about it.
At the outset, when people come into the hall, they're confronted with a scene which has a two-dimensional cardboard cutout kind of locomotive coming on stage and masses of billowing smoke which fills the hall.
Mm-hmm.
That from that very moment sets a seance-like attitude, which I think never dips down after that. There's something about that smoke moving out and encompassing.
It comes
the
back at the end too.
What is that you used actually to accomplish
just
that?
The old fog machine.
It's dry ice. Come
something
on.
Like that. Yeah, it is. As a matter of fact,
that's it's just an amazing effect, yeah. and it pulls people in beautifully.
Bob uses that with the lighting to a very good effect.
Robert Wilson. Right?
Bob Wilson. The lighting is extraordinarily precise and.
He must have had over 100 instruments focused, because
one of his complaints was that there were so few instruments, and they have to they have to replug dimmers all through the evening.
Well, it was a virtuosic job. Whoever the
he works with Beverly Emmons, the lighting designer.
I was thinking almost once that is done, almost more of the poor person who has to actually do the cues all night.
Well, calling the cues is a big job, and there are two people that call, one in the pit and one on stage. Calling the show is, and they have to be able to read music, and they call it from the score. It's all pretty precisely done. If you go from one night to the next, I tell you, it's an interesting thing about that. I timed the pieces, and I've timed it many nights. From one night to the next, there's less than 5 minutes difference in the 4 hours and 40 minutes.
It'll astonishing, isn't it?
It'll come out to 4:18 one night or 4:21. Or
it seemed to me that some of the chorus things that I heard, the 1-2, 1-2-3, 1-2-3-4, were done faster than on the commercial recording.
That's almost always true. And one of the interesting things about this music in general is that you get better at it.
How do you do that? How does a chorus learn to do that so quickly? I've tried to do that, and
they couldn't do it at the beginning. Uh-huh. There was 6 weeks of rehearsal before we opened. You know, it's like, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? You practice. You know, it's the old story. It's a lot of, in that way, when we talked about how music is difficult to play, one of the things about this music in general is that it's very demanding in many ways, in ways that people are not used to. One of the things that's gratifying for me as a composer is that how often, I have to say, first of all, that the first 2 weeks is always a period of shock for singers. I've gone through this with so many opera companies now, and they just don't—they don't think they're going to get through it, and they this and that. And something happens after when you get into the third week, they start to like it. And by the end of the rehearsal period, you usually get about 5 weeks before an opera goes on. They actually start to enjoy the work. And I've seen this happen so many times now that I know I have to, they have to just get through that first initial period of that first 2 week period before they find they have to find their way into the music and find where they have to find the that has to settle in their voices, that has to settle into their minds and their spirits in every way.
We're talking with Philip Glass, who will be performing on April 21st, Sunday at 8 p.m. at Davies Symphony Hall with the Philip Glass Ensemble. One thing I've often wondered about in thinking of Einstein on the Beach is the way you and Robert Wilson collaborated, and I don't think it's ever been very clear as to whether or not some of the images on stage were ideas of yours, or were they all Robert's ideas, or how did you work in that way?
That was pretty... the way we work is that... the images are Bob's. The music is mine. The way we share the authorship was we share the stage and we share the time. Certain ideas we formulated together. The overall structure of the piece we worked out together. He then began making a series of drawings to fit the themes, like the train theme, the trolley theme. That was worked out. Bob suggested the themes, and then I helped put them into the order that they went into. Bob made drawings. I then wrote music to the drawings. He then staged the action to the music.
Fascinating.
So that's how it worked. So, in other words, I had the drawings for the trial. We knew how long it was going to be because that was pre-decided. Then Bob heard the music, and he began staging to the music with the scene. So that at the moment that we began rehearsing, which was about a year before, we began rehearsing in November of 75, and the last performance of November of 76. The company was together for a whole year. The way we began working, I would come to the first rehearsal with the music, and Bob would come with the drawings, and he would explain to the company what the scene looked like, and I would play the music, and then Bob began to stage it, sometimes using improvisational techniques, sometimes with an idea of what he wanted.
And what was Lucinda Child's role in that?
There are four principal characters.
Andy Dugrow was the first
original
choreographer.
In the new production, there are two dances, and Lucinda choreographed the new dances, and also all the movement parts that she did. Our second production is more integrated for that reason, I think. There are four main characters. There's her and Cheryl Sutton, Mr. Johnson, and a young boy. In this case, it was Lute Brewer. These were all the original people, with the exception of Lute. The original Paul Mann, who was our original boy, is now 19 years old. He's 20 years old, and we couldn't. So we couldn't use him. I worked with. It was agreed that I would work with the ensemble. It was an ersatz opera company. We made it up ourselves. The original company was a total of 36 people, including all the stage people that we traveled around. This time we had a total of 70, because we divided the singers and dancers into two different companies. And originally we had the same people singing and dancing.
Was the production more efficient this time?
Much better. Much better.
In what ways?
Well, for one thing, we knew what we were doing before we began. Another thing is, I think it's important to remember that I think in 1976 we had a much more forgiving audience than we have today. I mean, the thing about the work when it appeared then, it was the first music theater work of that scale that anyone had seen in this tradition of new work. There had been works of, there are people who have been working, certainly, Richard Foreman and Meredith Monk, but I'm talking about a piece of this size. And I think people were so knocked out by that, in a way, I think all kinds of things were going wrong in that first production. I mean, microphones were stopped working, and, things didn't appear on the stage at the right time, and people forgot things. But I think people didn't even, they were so impressed with the intention and the ambition of the work that we were forgiven, in a way. We knew that we wouldn't have that this time around, so that we made the, we had to make the piece better, and in fact, it's the same piece. The staging is taken from the original tapes, the videotapes that we were made in 8 or 9 years ago. Admittedly, quite dark, but viewable. We could see what the score is the same, but in many ways the piece is a more finished piece, and I think it's a more viewable piece now too. We certainly play better, and it's certainly sung better. In a way, there's an ease to the piece that it didn't have. And it may be also the way we perceive things. The 8 years in between, there's been so much work since then by other people and by ourselves, different collectively and together, collectively and separately, that I think we're looking at work very differently. I mean, we're now in the middle of the ninth decade. You know, this is 85. We're half through the 80s. And we're just a little over half through the 70s. And it's been a big, I think there's been a lot of changes. It's very hard to even, in some ways, we don't even really know yet. It's hard to even be more precise about them.
It's even harder when you have a population of music critics who really are very far behind now. They're being left behind at a faster rate than they were in the early 20th century.
It's disappointing in a way that that's true. I find, in fact, that this work is remains controversial long beyond the time it should be, if I may put it that way. I guess everybody feels like, well, now everybody should accept this work and it should be that. I mean, I suppose everyone feels that way. But in fact, even new works of mine like Akhnaten, which I'll be playing part of that at this concert, by the way, and I'd like to talk a little bit about the concert in a moment, I don't see how that the language to me is no longer new.
You know now how Schoenberg felt in the 50s.
Oh, my goodness, I never even thought of that. No, I just think that it's not frightening any longer. I mean, people haven't thrown anything at us in 6 years. People did used to throw things. I mean, I'm talking about the general public. In a way, you know, our audiences have matured much more rapidly than our critics have. You know, and that's true of producers as well.
Well, let's face it, this is not a development which is unfamiliar to audiences that have been attracted to popular music. The problem here is that younger composers, you're now 48, but
that's right.
Right? Younger composers, those under 50.
I'm not young anymore, Gerald.
No, I'm saying that you are.
The younger
are combining influences from world music, popular music, jazz, all these things which are unfamiliar to critics of classical
music. But we began
music.
Doing that 20 years ago.
I understand that, yeah. But the critics have not been developing in
well,
in
somehow,
China.
Somehow, but generally speaking, I mean, Alan Rich certainly has. I can mention people, I guess there's no point in doing that. It's like giving, acknowledging certain. I mean, I think that people, they should be. I think it's their obligation to be part of the world that we live in, and I think singling people out is really not. But on the other hand, I think there are people that have been able to do it, and other people haven't. The thing is that when we play now, what I see with the ensemble, because I'm with the ensemble, I am now playing with people that have been playing with me. Some of them for 18 years, some of them for 20 years. Come to think of it, Jack Cripple since 1965, John Gibson, who was from this area anyway, since 67. And what we have now is an ensemble which really, I think more than any other modern music ensemble, really has been together all this time and has become a performing ensemble, which means we've been able to bring a level of playing which I think, in terms of my own music, I don't think could be matched. And one of the things that I find the most difficult is that so people even seem to acknowledge that. For example, one of the things that, even if you don't like the music, I think you'd say, my God, don't they play it well? But that's another level of criticism. We haven't even gotten to that yet. See, I think the real way the music should be, in my opinion, is that we should be talking about how the music's played. We don't even talk about that. We're still talking about the music. We're on a very, in terms of the criticism, and very few people talk about the performance level. Or are willing to talk about that, and yet that's something that we should be able to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. And it certainly goes beyond stylistic bias to.
Well, I think so, but for example, one of the things that I was so pleased that the LA Philharmonic could play the music that well, and I'm finding that there is a trickle-down effect too, that there are other, 5 or 6 years ago, people simply could not play the music at all, and it's one of those things, how funny it is that people learn to play music. I remember when the Carter Quartets were played the first time, it was considered a miracle that they could be played. And now music students can play Carter. I mean, it's something that we do learn. We assimilate playing techniques. And getting back to what we originally talked about. But then when we have a situation with an ensemble like mine, where you're talking about people who have played together for 17, 18 years, it's really like a string quartet, isn't it? Or like the modern jazz quartet. Where people, that what happens is that, and it's a remarkable thing, is that you begin hearing things in the music that you didn't even know were there. It's like and it leads me to think that if new music was played, for example, the pianist that will play a Schubert sonata 200 times, but they'll play a It's not a by, well, I don't know. Let's say Aziz Nacht doesn't get played so much, but that if as much care was lavished on music, that I think the music would begin to speak and sing in a way that no one knows. And I've seen that with my own music.
Now, that's what Charles Wernand says about difficult
I think
and austere avant-garde music.
I think that's one of the places that Charles and I can agree on.
I think that's right. But there's another place where you disagree, which is that he says that music which has these influences from non-European classical music that it is offensive to equate them with serious contemporary music. That's where you part
ways. How well does Charles know that music, I wonder?
I don't think well at all.
Well, see, I have the advantage on him then, don't I? Should I take advantage of my advantage? I mean,
please.
I mean, the point is that, what's interesting about popular music, it's changed so much in the last... even in the last 15 years. And one of the ways it's changed is it has to do with the recording techniques and the way that music is recorded, that young people think in a more complex way than they used to because of the simple process of overdubbing, you know. Even if you go back, and you know, the real beginning of this, it's really Les Paul that began that, of course. I mean, anyone who knows about electronic music knows about that and about the multi-tracking and that stuff, which has now become part of the language of popular music, too. It becomes one of the techniques, I should say, the technique of popular music. And it's made it possible for me to work with people in popular music because we're working with very similar technology.
But you see, you're ignoring your patrimony, which is the Western European musical heritage when you do
that.
Yeah,
that's what Mademoiselle Boulanger used to say that to me, too.
Aha, uh-huh. Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Maybe that's where Mr. Wernand got it.
Did he study? I don't think he.
I
spent
no,
a lot of time with
so.
Her. I spent a lot of time with her, and she used to say to me, not used to, but she
did
said.
Did she use
to,
that word?
No. She said, and I would say this, I was with her almost 3 years. And she said, and almost with tears in her eyes, you know, she was quite, this was, she said, you know, one of the things that makes me so sad with you Americans, or you people from America, or young composers, is that you have no sense of history. And she said, and of course, I instinctively knew that that was our advantage. Among the fellow students that I knew then, there was a big, big difference between the young French composers or the Germans and the young Americans, is that their history is crushing. It was the saddest thing. I mean, it seemed that way to me. Of course, to them, the sadness was on the other side. They thought it was sad for me. But for me, to see them at the very beginning of their careers to be so weighted and crushed by these decisions. And for
what
us,
what years
very,
were those then?
I was there from 62 to 65.
Because in the early 70s, they began in Germany, particularly to invite Buddhist monks from Japan and pygmies from Central Africa.
Oh, yes, that
but
was the
only
metamusic.
After minimalism had taken
Walter
taken
Bauer at the Meta Music Festival
right.
in Berlin.
That's
I knew
right.
Walter. And, you know, Walter was involved with Kane Askazi, too, with that film. Yeah, Walter was the person that did that. And I was on that festival a couple of years, yeah.
Well, it was a later development at any rate. And when they finally blew open the doors and said, there may be something important here besides Beethoven, Brahms.
Well, that was already in the same. And the Germans were very quick to pick up on that. And of course, in point of fact, the popular music that began changing there. The early Donna Summer's Giorgio Moroder stuff was German, was done in Germany. Of course, you know that.
No, I didn't know that.
Yes. Well then, that's a lot of the
What changed specifically?
I can remember some of the stuff that was done in the early 70s. It was amazingly, it was very reductive. Do I dare use the word minimal? It was like minimal pop music. A lot of it was synthesizer stuff that was done very early. People like the bands that were working that way were Tangerine Dream, whom I met at that time. And Kraftwerk, those were the early, those German synthesizer bands.
How did Donna Summers fit in, though?
I don't know, she just, well, that's when it became, that was the first popular music that grew out of it. It was the first music that became enormously popular, that grew out of that interfacing.
I thought you meant she was recording in Germany and the engineers did something.
No. I meant that stylistically, that it was related to that.
Yeah, of course.
In fact, that was the first, The connection is very, very clear. I was playing in Europe a lot in those days.
Did you see Peter Michael Hamill then? at some of the festivals.
Yeah, and who's that other guy? The other Peter, the one with Tangerine Dream. I forget. It doesn't matter. But I think it's important to remember that Germany was the place that the ensemble did most of our concerts in Germany, in Cologne and Düsseldorf and Bochum and Aachen.
So it was a definite connection. I mean, there was an influence.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, we were
very
there.
Concrete.
Yeah, very concrete. And Walter Bakar, who had this festival, was fond of putting us all together. And we talked. In fact, my first recordings with Virgin Records were because of Tangerine Dream. They said, oh, there's this real hip record company in England, and you should go and see them. And I took my music there, and they thought, oh, here comes another German band. You know, I didn't have any idea what it was. And they put out two records, which are still in print. I still get statements from them every year. The North Star record and Music in 12 Parts 1 and 2. That was Virgin Records. So that they were actually very helpful to me. In fact, one of the things that happened for me is that association I had in those days in the early 70s with these popular musicians, it helped develop the audiences to a great degree. They talked about my music. They were not reluctant at all to talk about it, and they played it on, and they promoted it, frankly. I mean, David Bowie was the same thing. He liked the music, and he talked about it, and they wanted people to know about it. And we were talking about the audience had changed so much so rapidly in the 70s, and we have this, what we're familiar with now is this crossover audience, which has spilled over into the new music world, into the, where that, and it works both ways, so that you have people like David Byrne, who comes out of the high art world, and it gets very complicated. I mean, it gets very interesting, too. And the point is that the categories have simply dissolved in many ways, and it's not clear. People who go to hear Ravi Shankar one night might go hear Talking Heads one night, and then they'll come and hear us play another night, and then go see Paul Taylor dance, so that you have people who are not thinking about the whole thing about high art and low art and high culture and low culture is quite more interesting than it used to be. So the proposition that you stated at the original part of this question about Charles and the patrimony of the, well, simply not that way. I think Americans, we as usual, we've done things our own way. The ones who have not felt so bound by that European tradition, maybe it's partly because I lived there that I didn't care for it so much, that you end up doing things in quite a different way.
There's a very establishment-oriented feeling in Europe. There isn't a lot of loft activity in France.
No, it's
for
a
example.
Big problem, actually. It's been a big problem for their... they're the radio stations, and they can be in the hands of different kinds of people, depending on what city you are. One of the things about America that's been so interesting is that you can have all different kinds of movements that you never... One of the great frustrations for Boulez when he lived in New York was that he couldn't control the music world as he did in Paris. The young French composers were so happy when he left Paris, and they were so sad when he came back, because when he was gone, it was like there was this patriarch was gone, the guy that was telling everybody what they should do, he simply wasn't there. It didn't work so well for him in New York. Simply no one paid any attention. He did his concerts, which were good in their own way. We did ours downtown. He did his uptown and whatever. But the ability for to have a really heterogeneous music life, the expectation that we would have one has been really here. And something that we, you know, the thing about Americans, they just have no respect. And it's what saved us in many ways.
Well, it's produced also people like Laurie Anderson and others who simply wouldn't have thrived in a foreign country.
And you know, we don't work in a vacuum. The public that we have, it's what we're experiencing now, and I think is a really interesting thing. You're experiencing performing artists who have real publics. And of course, then you get the reaction, well, the negative side, or the people say, well, these people are playing down to the public, appearing to the public, but I don't think so. I think they're playing for the best public they can imagine, and the public arrives and appears. I think that you write you write up to the public and not down, and that the public is there. And the idea that, it's just an old-fashioned idea that true art can only have a small public, first of all, it's not true. I mean, the composers of the 19th century were enormously popular, and could be.
And their music was almost exclusively the music which was played in their time.
I think that it's not. I think that we can that we have a right to expect that.
Well, as Charles Scheer was saying to me yesterday, why is it that when you read the sports section, it's about sports that are about today, and the business section deals with things today, and the music section is discussing Beethoven.
I always think about in terms of clothing. I mean, can you imagine, what if everyone were dressed in the style of the music that they were listening to? You'd walk in the concert and you'd laugh. You'd just laugh. I mean, it would be laughable, wouldn't it? But in fact, we do it all the time and don't notice.
But the funny thing, I mean, it's not bad to have museums for this kind of music. The problem is we almost exclusively put all of our major funds into it.
Yeah, it's a question of proportion. I think that's what we're talking about. I mean, no one is going to, so to tell you the truth, I don't really care about that.
Well, let's talk about a conductor who's made a difference, Dennis Russell Davies. He has consistently shown that contemporary music can be saleable to the public and enjoyable and educational and so forth.
Yeah.
But there are very few conductors who have taken the lead that he's exhibited.
Well, there are some younger Americans out there. Chris Rakeen is another person who plays a lot of new music and people that no one knows.
Where is he now?
Was at New York City Opera, but it's all...
He's
at Syracuse and he's starting another orchestra, I think. I'm not sure. I think he's starting something in Florida.
Has he played anything of yours?
At the City Opera, he's done Satya Graha and Akhenaten.
Mm-hmm. But I mean with his orchestra?
No, because I don't have any orchestra music. I've only written operas, really.
Uh-huh.
It's interesting. When I'm visiting Dennis, he has a much broader interest. He has a much broader taste in music than I do. And I'll go to his house and I'll look at this music and say, Dennis, how can you play this music? Because it's something that I don't particularly like. And he said, he loves it all. Dennis loves it. It's so interesting the way he can relate to so much different kinds of music. I find it not, personally, my vision of music tends to be fairly much narrower in terms of the music that I actually like listening to. But I think I would support almost anyone who was, I think that had an authentic relationship to their music in terms of technique and style and was living at the time that we're living right now. Certainly, radio has been one of the biggest helps for this. The music is heard more on the radio than almost anywhere. Film has helped too. And I think that, you know, you can see it in the audiences. There's no doubt now that there's an audience for a kind of new music that's, I think, frank about its origins and clear about its intentions.
One wonderful thing about your music is that it has a very definite character. So all of the people who were saying for years that you had to have your own individual voice, Copeland, Ives, all of these people, would be able to turn on the television set this summer, and as somebody's running around a track, recognize in three bars that Philip Glass has written something for the Olympics.
Yeah, that was fun. I loved that.
It was absolutely fabulous because I was expecting the worst as Rafer Johnson ran up with the torch to the highest point.
Oh, you didn't know I had gotten that commission?
I had no idea that you had the commission. And I said, I turned to Carol and I said, Carol, do you think it's... Yes, it is.
that was wonderful.
It was absolutely a wonderful way to come across the music, because here we had a couple of Hollywood composers before you, and it was pretty boring stuff.
But there wasn't Gershwin, too, on the program.
That's true, but those 84 pianists weren't playing the piano. That was
extremely
disappointing to me. I wanted to hear all that out of sync.
I know.
Louis Moreau Gottschalk extravaganza.
Didn't really happen.
And here was this perfectly in
sync
single
watch
piano.
But you did watch the program.
Of course. I'm a sports fanatic, Phil.
Uh-huh.
That's why I don't get as much music written as you do. So,
We all have our excuses.
What sports are you interested in?
Well, I guess I'm just whatever happens to be on. I'm not so interested in any particular thing.
Well, you don't have the San Francisco 49ers out where you come
from. That's
right.
So. I find I actually watch boxing more than anything.
Is that right?
Yeah, and I've never done that in my life.
Uh-huh. Well, there's a lot of it on these days and at odd hours. So.
Yeah, but, you know, the thing about America is that culturally what we really are interested in sports and television. And then we'll let art come in somewhere or other. But in fact, there's an enormous amount of interest in the performing arts. I mean, I think, you know, we tend to think of our country as an artsy bunker country in many ways. But then when you go out and start playing, like I'm on this tour right now, and it's amazing how... the thirst and interest and real need for music and new music and new art. I find it in Baltimore or Miami or Atlanta or any place. It's wonderful.
Well, new music and contemporary music is better than it's ever been. It just keeps getting
better.
It's a
very good period. It's a real golden age. I was talking to someone about opera, and they asked me what I thought about opera, and I said, there is a new golden age of opera, and it's happening right now. And the best thing that can happen is for people to be aware of it and not to be missing it while it's really happening.
Because these things can't be documented except in live performance.
It's really fun. There's so much interest in composers working in theater now, whether it's Paul Drescher, George Coates out here, or
Anthony Davis.
Anthony Davis, I was going to mention Anthony.
Malcolm X opera.
And myself, certainly, it's become a very compelling interest for me. And in Europe, it's become what's happened is that opera producers like the City Opera or Harvey at Brooklyn are discovering that they can sell tickets for this stuff. Though Harvey did it long before he could sell tickets.
Harvey Lichtenstein.
But people like the Houston Opera is discovering that they can have some of their biggest sales on the night when they're premiering an opera that no one's heard, which was happening with Akhenaten. And so that what's happened is I'm starting to get interest in commissions in America now. The producers would like to do new work. I think they were, I'm talking about the producers, they were mostly worried about the economic aspects of it. And one of the things that they ask about, and I know this, when the opera producers meet, when they meet someone like Harvey or they talk to Beverly Sills about me, and they'll say, well, how did the tickets go? And they find out they sold out. And then they start to think differently about it and say, wait a second, if they're selling out, that means that there's a public there that wants this. And they have been quicker than the critics to see what's happening in that way, that there's something very lively happening in terms of music theater, in terms of a public, in terms of composers.
And that's one fewer Donizetti opera you have to schedule next year, because you won't sell all the tickets for those operas.
That's right. Akhenaten, we did, five performances in New York, and it was sold out a month before we opened. You couldn't find a ticket.
Why have these pieces not been done on the West Coast?
I don't know. And we haven't so far had a real opera community in Los Angeles. There certainly is one in San Francisco. I would like to present work here.
I think we could easily fill the Opera House three nights for any one of your operas.
Oh, I think so.
Easily.
I think so. There are composers here. There's a very good opera composer here, Conrad Souza, who I knew for years. And Conrad's had his work done in Holland and in Minneapolis and New York, and I don't know if he's had work done here, but there's so you've got a composer right here who is not having work done, let alone someone coming from somewhere else. I don't know the opera world here. I don't know Terry McKeown at all. And maybe, for all we know, they're thinking about it. Maybe they're going to call me tomorrow.
Hey.
I hope so. I mean,
that's the right attitude.
That's the only attitude to take. I think that my feeling is that people want to do it, and if they feel that their public will go along with them, there you have a different matter. You have subscribers and people that are buying a ticket for all of the other kinds of things, and then they're going to include a Philip Glass opera or a Conrad Souza opera in that subscription thing.
Well, it would cost a couple hundred thousand dollars for four performances, would be about right. I mean, they could make that back easily at the gate by charging $30 or $50 a ticket.
The thing is, with the companies that are new to this work, is the best thing for them to do is to have some non-subscription nights too, where they can draw on the public that will be coming to Davis Hall, we hope, for this concert, but maybe never went to the opera before.
Let's mention this concert again. We're talking with Philip Glass. His concert is Sunday, April 21st at 8 p.m. For tickets, you can call the San Francisco Symphony box office at Davis Symphony Hall, 431-5400. Tickets are $10 through $20 and are available at Davis Symphony Hall box office, Ticketron, and all Bass outlets. And you can charge by phone at that number I gave, 431-5400. Sunday, April 21st, 8 p.m., Davis Hall. You said you wanted to mention something about the music you were playing. Is there?
I think I more or less talked about it.
Okay.
I was talking about in terms of the ensemble, which I feel, let me just say, it's a group I'm very proud of to be associated with, and most of them have been with me a long time. John Gibson, Richard Peck, and Jack Kribble for quite a while. Michael Reisman and Martin Goldrey is new, just in the last 2 years, as a new synthesizer player. The work has gotten more symphonic, I've had to add new synthesizers to the group. We have 8 synthesizers now.
And you have your own engineer, of course.
Oh, Kurt McCasey's been with us, God, since 1970, and also acts as a record producer, Andrew Ornstein, who is our singer. And it's something that doesn't get talked about very much is who these people are that are playing. And that some of them are composers on their own, certainly John Gibson, as you know, Michael Reisman is as well, but that something happens when, you know, a group stays together that long and you've played a piece 300 times and you start to reach a level of playing which I just think is very exciting. And I think that's one of the things I'm happiest about.
Yeah, I'm very happy that you're coming here to do the program because the...
you have to do it live.
Yeah.
I mean, I can do it on... I can give you a record and you'll probably play it, but I don't think we have to worry about live performance. People love to see music live, and we love to play it live, and it's such a vital part of being a musician, as you know. Why do we go to all the trouble of coming out here to play? I mean, we can just stay home and just send records out here, but I think that aspect of the music and hearing it live is extremely important.
Before we close, could you tell us about your current projects?
I got two, if not three, but the one that I'm most concerned with and really very up on right now is I'm working with Doris Lessing on an opera.
Oh boy, a space opera, huh?
Yeah, as a matter of fact.
How exciting.
It's we're working on the making of the representative for Planet 8, and that will be premiered in Holland in 86, and then it will come to Houston, I think 86, 87, I don't know where after, that's going to New York after that. I've been working with Mrs. Lessing for about a year on the libretto now, and I'm just starting the music now. I've got sketches on my desk at home, and I've got to finish it by the fall.
Because it's in outer space, is it going to be different from ancient Egypt?
Oh, I think so. But you know, after Akhenaten, I couldn't do any more portrait operas. I was almost getting typecasting myself as a person who wrote operas about people.
And now everybody else is doing it, of course.
Is that so?
Yeah, well, look at Malcolm X.
Oh, yeah, but Anthony Davis, you know, that was he's a wonderful person to do an opera about. And I think it's wonderful that David Andrew's doing it. It's a subject, actually, I would have been interested in, but it wasn't my subject. And it's his, you know. Obviously, Malcolm X. It's about the black experience in America at a certain point, and it's something that I think I would never have been able to do so well.
Also John Adams working on Nixon in China.
Is he?
Yeah.
Oh,
that's
good. Terrific. I think that I've always felt that John could be a terrific theater composer. I mean, he's done mostly orchestra stuff.
That's
and we
right,
talked
yeah.
about that once. I think the first, he did that one dance for Listener, but I think that, you know, to be a theater composer, I just say this, that it's a lifetime apprenticeship in the theater. And you just spend your life working on it and learning how to write in the theater and how to be a theater composer. But, John could certainly be an important. I mean, if he puts his energy into it, I think he can be.
What about this space idea, though?
When we say it's a space, the important thing about it, it's an allegorical opera. I mean, the story is about the Planet 8 has, for some cosmological disaster has taken place, and the heat of its sun, the sun has moved out of its. The planet has moved out of its orbit so that it's lost a lot of the heat, and the planet is freezing to death. And what's happening is that the neighboring planet, Canopus, has promised to remove them. They were going to take the whole population and take them to another planet called Rohanda, which is actually the Earth. And for some reason, they don't do it. And at a certain point, the people realize that they're going to be stuck on this planet, and the planet is going to freeze over, which is what's happening throughout the opera. And the question is, well, what are they going to do? So it's more or less like, it's not that different from looking at the evening news, in other words.
What about the scoring? We have. Do you have a particular set
of instruments
in mind? I have
a large orchestra. I have a small chorus. I bargain with the Netherlands Opera about that. I said, I take a small chorus if they give me a big orchestra. That's how you have to deal with opera companies. And it's a chorus about 18. That's only three or four solo parts. And the thing that interests me about it is that for me, Mrs. Lessing has a way of writing allegorically about things that are very much current. When I say it's like looking at the news, to me, that's the world we live in is very much reflected in the world that she writes about. And in a certain way, by making it an allegory, she makes it easier for us to think about it. I mean, somehow, if you wrote a piece about the extinction of the Earth, I mean, it'd be just it's just so unthinkable that you just don't know how to write it, you don't know how to get people to look at it, and it's that kind of, but you call it Planet 8, you make it a different people, you put it in a different time, and you talk about the very same things that are happening to us right now. So when you call it a space opera, yeah, it's in a certain way it is, and in another way it's as much about space as the Bible is about us. I mean, I think it's where we find ourselves in these works that make them relevant and important to us.
What about your other projects, Philip Glass?
I'm working also on a record of songs, which I'm also doing this year. Did I tell you about the songs
no.
I spoke?
No.
I got the idea I rather asked myself the question, what would it sound like if I wrote songs? I don't mean popular songs. I mean the tradition of, well, what do I mean? I don't mean art songs, certainly. I'm not going to do that. But I didn't know. You see, I simply didn't. So I thought, well, what would a song be like? Because I'd never done it. And then I thought, well, the main problem with song are the words. And it seemed to me that the best words for songs were written by songwriters, not poets. So I asked my friends who were songwriters if they would give me lyrics, and I would write a record of songs. CBS said that they would make the record, so that's what we're doing. I asked David Byrne and Laurie Anderson, and they've agreed. In fact, their words are done. Paul Simon is doing a set of words for me. And I have another person who I asked, and actually Stephen Sondheim, but he was in the middle of another musical, and he said he'd do volume two, but not volume one. And so I have one other songwriter who I've asked, and I haven't gotten any word from yet, so I can't say yet. So what I intend to do is to write a song and an instrumental. And
don't forget Yoko Ono.
Well, I've actually thought. You know what was interesting to me about? I'm interested in people who write. I'm interested in that aspect of the part of it that has to do with the words, because I think that the songwriters are the ones that know how the words work. The thing that's always struck me is that, and I'm sure it's, why is it that English is so hard to understand when it's on the opera stage and so easy to understand when Lou Reed sings it? Or why is that? You know, I don't know why that is. Why can English be such an agreeable language to listen to in one kind of genre and not in another? And I think if we could figure that out.
It's the throbbing wobble of the opera singer.
Do you think so?
Yeah, and the lack of an FM microphone on the lapel.
Well, I've been working with opera singers, but in different languages. Now, by the way, the representative is in English. And it's going to require a different kind of singing. I think you're right. You know, and I think in a certain way I've established the need for a different kind of singing in my work, and that I think there is now an expectation. When people come to audition for an opera of mine, they kind of know what they're getting into, and if they don't, well they could easily find out. Anyway, those are the two that I'm working on. After that, I have some other things.
There's a film score, right?
I just finished that. That was the work I did for Paul Schrader on his film about Yukio Mishima.
Do you know the title of the movie?
Mishima. And it'll be, I think they're going to, it'll be opening in the spring and in the summer in Europe, and it should be here in the fall.
It's been a pleasure talking with you, Philip Glass. Thanks for coming to KPFA.
It's good to talk to you, Charles.